I want to recommend a great book to you here as we welcome you back. Another edition here on Book Corner. Tony Basilio along with Betty Metzger. She is the author of The Burglary, which is a discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's secret FBI. And this is not only something Betty has written a book about, but this is something that Betty was in the middle of. Not the burglary itself, but when it was time for this group to promulgate exactly what they had done, what they had found, Betty was on the front lines of this. And Betty, the first thing I want to do is welcome you to our segment today, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
How did you arrive? And as I mentioned, you were sort of on the front end of this, but let's rewind the clock, if we will. We go back to the late 60s, a turbulent time, obviously, in America. You had the Vietnam War there. You have a protest movement, and you have all these different influences on these folks at the time. Why did you feel like this would be such an excellent story all these years later to tell?
Well, it had such an enormous impact years later. At the time that it happened, at the time that the burglary took place in March of 1971, and then the files were released, that was the first time that America learned that someone who was one of the American idols, J. Edgar Hoover, was actually functioning in a very different way than they had thought. So the power was great at that initial point when the revelations came out that massive political spying was taking place, plus all kinds of very serious harassment by the FBI, including violence against some people. But then, years later, it kept having an impact and ultimately led to the first official investigations of the FBI by both houses of Congress and major reforms taking place. So then, many years after that, when I accidentally found two of the burglars, I naturally thought that given the power of what they and other people had done, the other burglars, that this was an important piece of American history that was missing and needed to be told.
You know, I think you're right. Quick story for you. I'm originally from Pennsylvania.
Oh, really?
Southeastern Pennsylvania. So I right outside of Westchester. I was home recently.
Near media.
Yeah, and I was telling my brother, who's in his mid to late 50s, about this book I'm reading, and he said, you know, I'm really not familiar with that. He had it confused with something else. He said, I'm really not familiar with that burglary, and I'm thinking, if folks in those parts, if it was basically a footnote to them, what has it been like to the rest of us? And that's why, as I read this, Betty, I was thinking, why haven't I heard? Why don't we know anything about this? Because as I read your book, I come to learn that what these folks did was extremely brave, daring, but also influential through the lens of time.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the main reason that it sort of got lost was that they never were found. The FBI had this huge investigation going. As you can imagine, J. Edgar Hoover was enraged that his secrets were coming out for the first time. But the fact that they were never arrested meant that their names never became known, and that the coverage of what they did stayed focused on the substance of the files rather than on the people. And I think that that had a significant impact at the time on why people were very concerned about what happened. But then as time passed, that got merged into a focus on what the FBI had done and not on who in the world did this. In fact, Daniel Ellsberg has said that he thinks that that made a big difference in what ultimately happened in terms of investigating the intelligence agencies in comparison to what he modestly says about his release of the Pentagon Papers. He thinks that the coverage of the Pentagon Papers very quickly turned to people being consumed by coverage of him. both in terms of the criminal charges against him, but also the Nixon administration burglarizing his psychiatrist's office. And as a result of that, he thinks that unfortunately many people of interest focused on him rather than on reading the Pentagon Papers themselves or the stories about the Pentagon Papers themselves. I think there's some substance to that, although I think it's also true that because of what people learned from the Pentagon Papers did probably shift many more people's opinions against the war.
I want to hit the reset button here because people are listening. We're 5 minutes in, and they're saying, okay, this burglary they keep talking about. First of all, when did the burglary happen? And if you could set that up for us. And then those that carried out the burglary, interestingly enough, I learned from your work, were folks that you would not expect, especially if you were to look back through their past, you would not expect that they would be involved in this sort of thing. It was a rather daring and bold thing that they did. It's just such an interesting story. So can you help us to rewind a little bit of it?
Sure. When it occurred is interesting, and it occurred on the night of March 8, 1971. And that was not an accident. When they started planning, they had come together as a group for the first time by the end of December. And they had to pick a night. And they needed to pick a night so that they could then make their casing of the area around the building and of the building itself be at the same time and day of the week that the burglary would take place. And one of them remembered during that discussion that something very important was coming up, and that was the Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier, first world championship boxing match. And that was going to be the night of March 8th at Madison Square Garden. And it was predicted that this was going to be the fight of the century, if not the sporting event of the century. It was going to be the first fight for Ali since he had to leave the ring in 6 years earlier, when he was convicted for refusing to serve in the military because of his opposition to the Vietnam War. And so the fight had sort of the same lines that so many issues had at that time, lines determined by people's position for or against the war. Many people were enthusiastic about the fight because of Ali and how much they liked him, not only as a fighter, but also because of what he stood for. I mean, the same thing was true of Frazier. Richard Nixon publicly announced his support of Frazier and actually had Frazier come to the White House. So the night was very important. And the burglars thought that all people would be so interested in watching the fight that night that it would in effect be a decoy, provide white noise. For instance, they thought that no self-respecting FBI agent would be in the office that night. And they also thought that maybe the media Pennsylvania police wouldn't make their regular rounds that night because they would be watching or listening to the fight. But perhaps even more importantly, they thought that the apartments, there were two floors above the FBI office in this small building, and they thought that the people who lived in those apartments and the manager of the building who lived right below the FBI office might be distracted by the noise from the fight. So that was why that night was chosen. And you ask who they were. You're right. If you met them, they were not the kind of people that you would have thought would be burglars, especially who would think that anybody would think they could burglarize an FBI office. The leader of the group was mild-mannered physics professor at Haverford College. And he had been involved in the peace movement really ever since the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. As a physicist, he was very aware of the enormous power involved in those bombs, but even more fearful of the power that would be in future nuclear weapons, and devoted his life to opposing the use of nuclear weapons, and that made it natural that he was very concerned about the Vietnam War. And he had noticed how hopeless people in the peace movement had become by early 1970 and was very concerned about whether the war would ever stop, but also what would happen to people in the peace movement as they felt more and more desperate about whether the war would ever end. So he felt a need to find more aggressive ways to use nonviolence and became involved with the Catholic peace movement. And some of those people were burglarizing draft boards at that time. And so he never would have thought of the possibility of burglary except for that. So when he started thinking, when people convinced him in 1970 that there were spies in the midst of the peace movement in all types of organizations, he rejected it, and then he finally, by late fall, thought it was true and that it was such a big problem that it must be solved. He regarded it as like a second war, that there was a war going on in Vietnam, but that there was a war sent going on at home that must be stopped. And he also had confidence, as did the other burglars, that if the American people were presented with solid evidence that that was happening rather than rhetoric, that they would be so upset that they would do something about it. That turned out to be true. And the people he recruited were an interesting group of people. Two of them were John and Bonnie Raine. They were a married couple, a young married couple. John was a professor of religion at Temple University. Bonnie was the director of a daycare center in Philadelphia. And they had, at that time, three children under the age of 8. And they had made an extraordinary decision for a married couple. A few years earlier, they had promised each other that they hoped that if they were ever presented with an opportunity to engage in an act of resistance, that they thought could have an impact in against a serious kind of injustice, they hoped that they would have the courage to join such an act. And as they thought about Bill Davidson's question to them, what do you think of burglarizing an FBI office? They decided to say yes because they thought that was such an act of resistance that might have a positive impact. They took it under consideration with their eyes open, and they went to his brother and asked him if he would raise their children if they had to serve years in prison. And his brother agreed to do that. It was a very unusual thing for a young couple to do at that time. And the other people in the group included, for instance, Keith Forsyth and Bob Williamson. They were very young. They were 20, 21 at the time. And they were part of that small, very dedicated part of the peace movement that cared so strongly about stopping the war that they dropped out of college to spend as much time as possible working against the war. Keith, soon after he made his commitment to participate in the burglary, took a correspondence course in locksmithing so that he could figure out how to pick the lock on the FBI office. He had walked by and noticed that there was one lock, and it was a rather simple lock. He bought two just like it, made his own lock-picking tools, practiced night by night in the Raines attic as the other people talked about their casing findings, and thought that he had gotten his break-in time down to 30 seconds. I should say there were 8 burglars, and I found 7 of them. And 2 of the other 7 who told their story but who chose not to be named in the book or the documentary film that's been made were Ron Durst and Susan Smith. Susan Smith also was a college professor in the area, and she, like John Raines, had gone south each year during the civil rights movement in the early 1960s, and that was the sort of the heart of her commitment to injustice. And then there was Ron Durst. He was in his mid-20s at the time of the burglary and was a graduate student learning to be in a health profession. And his commitment to injustice and to fighting the war had come from growing up in a family where his parents were Holocaust survivors. And also, he, as he grew up, he heard countless stories about the aunts and uncles he would never know because they had not survived the Holocaust. And never again as it pertained to such enormous injustice, was at the core of his life. And then as he became active in the peace movement, he thought of never again applying to the bombing of Laos, the bombing of Cambodia, and the bombing and all of the other parts of the war that applied to Vietnam. So those are the other people. Those are the people who answered Bill Davidson's call and said yes, that they would like to figure out whether it would be possible to break into an FBI office.
Let's forward the clock to now. You're writing this book. You're putting this work together. You reach out to these folks all these years later, and you find several who choose to participate. Did it surprise you that they chose to participate, put their names out there in the numbers that they did?
Well, for, maybe we should explain how I found it. I wasn't looking for them. I found them quite by accident. I had moved from Washington to California, and many years after all of this, I was on a trip east, and I went to Philadelphia for a weekend. I had worked in Philadelphia before. I was a reporter at the Washington Post and received the files from them. And on that trip to Philadelphia many years later, I made appointments to see people who were former colleagues and acquaintances during that time. And the one of those evenings, I had dinner at the home of John and Bonnie Raines. Now, I had no idea who the burglars were. And as I said, they were acquaintances from that time, people that I had stayed in touch with occasionally. And we had not seen each other for many years, so we had a lot of catching up to do. But during the course of the dinner, John, the dog, their youngest child, their fourth child, came into the dining room to ask one of them a question. And John Raines said, "Mary, we want you to know, Betty, because many years ago when your dad and mother had information about the FBI that we wanted the American public to have, we gave it to Betty." And that's how I learned that they were among the burglars, and it was a great shock. I also learned that night, though, that they had all vowed 10 days after the burglary, when they finished collating and were ready to distribute the material, that they vowed to each other that they would take the secret of the burglary to their graves, and that they also would not associate with each other in the future for fear that the arrest of one could lead to the arrest of another. So I was stunned to learn that information, got back in touch with John and Bonnie Raines sometime later, and said that I would like to write about this. I wanted them to think about whether they would be willing to be public with their story, and if they were, would they help me find the other burglars. And five of them were quite willing to retract that vow of silence and became convinced that it was an important story to tell. And I'll be forever grateful for that. And the other two also saw the value in telling the story, each for different reasons, just didn't want to use their name. And I guess when you ask if I was surprised, I was just so glad. I guess I didn't think, I was surprised to find any of the burglars in the first place. But I think as they talked to each other in response to my question, that by that point, years later, and they felt relatively safe, they didn't yet know, but in fact, the statute of limitations on the crime had passed and the investigation had been stopped actually at 5 years.
What I think is really interesting that you did in this book, and as people who, like yourself, are gifted that do what you do, and that's why you've had a great, long, and distinguished career in journalism, is you got both sides to sort of tell the story here. You got folks from the FBI side to talk about, this is what we were thinking, this is where we were chasing, this is what we were doing. And then as we visit with Betty Metzger, the book is The Burglary, the Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. It's from Knopf, and I would encourage you to check it out. Believe me, we are just touching the surface on this. It is a book that you will be unable to put down. But you got both sides to sort of talk about the cat and mouse in this. And I found myself thinking about being in the shoes of the burglars and how these people tried to live normal lives against the specter of the shadow of what they had done, knowing that the hammer could fall on them at any time. They could be found out at any time. And some of the, what in their minds were close calls, which in fact weren't really close calls at all. I mean, it was such a great story, wasn't it? Just from that aspect.
You're right. I mean, they felt very much like close calls. Some of them may have been, but because we know that the FBI never had any evidence of who was involved, we can know in retrospect that most of those close calls were guesses rather than actual close calls. My goal was to not just tell, once I knew who the burglars were, my goal wasn't to just say, okay, here's who these people are, and here's what motivates, and here's how they pulled this off. I also wanted to tell it from inside the FBI investigation, which was possible because of some agents talking, but also because of the extensive record, 34,000 pages, that I was able to get of the official record of the FBI investigation of the burglary. But I also wanted to tell the story of the impact of the burglary, which was really quite amazing, and we're still learning from that today. The burglary led to quite a few things. Prior to the burglary, there was no access to information about what any of the intelligence agencies were doing in the public's name. And that changed as a result of the information that started coming out and then came out in a stream as of the middle of the 1970s when the Church Committee hearings took place and officials testified about the illegal activities, some of them quite extreme, that took place. But you're right, if people are very interested in knowing what it was like to try to go back to your normal lives, which some of them did quite successfully. It turned out that if you already had your education and you had a job, as Bill Davidson and the Rainses did, and you had a family, that it was much easier to continue, quote, a normal life, sort of because you had to. You went to work every day, and you had to earn an income to pay the mortgage. And those people did that, but along the way, there were many close calls, and that especially for the Rainses, including two FBI agents coming to their home one day and interviewing John. Now, of course, he had no idea of knowing that instead of coming under more intense investigation after that visit in which he refused to say whether he was involved in the media burglary, that just 2 weeks later, his name was removed from the list of suspects in the case. But Bonnie had cased the FBI office inside, and a police artist had drawn a picture of her in response to the description that the agents who saw her remembered. It so happened that the day the FBI agents visited them, Bonnie arrived home just 5 minutes after they left. Now, that was a close call, though they didn't know her name. If they had seen her face, I think that in all likelihood, they probably would have recognized her as the woman who cased the inside of the FBI office.
Couple other thoughts for you as we visit today with Betty Metzger. The Burglary is the name of the book, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI, and it's from Knopf, and you know, we're discussing this work, which centers around a burglary back in the early 70s, Media, Pennsylvania, and how it helped change the landscape of not only the way the FBI is viewed, but the way, hopefully, the FBI has operated in recent years, though who really knows. What I think is interesting about your work here is you talk about the FBI is just exactly how Fruit Loops and how much of a fruitcake, just crazy, J. Edgar Hoover was. I mean, some of the things that these people were able to get their hands on was remarkable, that it was just sitting in there in a little satellite office. I mean, they had to think when they risked a burglary, they had to think there's going to be something here worth our while. What they found was a treasure trove, wasn't it?
It was. It's important important to realize, though, that they took that risk that could have resulted in decades in prison. They took that risk without having the slightest idea whether they would find a single piece of significant information in that little FBI office. I mean, it was a small satellite office. And many people later would say, why in the world would they have thought there was anything in there? Well, they really didn't know. I mean, as it turned out, I think you probably could have found significant information in just about any FBI office in the country. Now, as to what they found, I mean, what they found was very significant, but, and then also what those findings led to later, that's what really led the public to demand that, Congress take action and investigate not just the FBI, but all intelligence agencies. What they found, for instance, in the first set of files that I received were some rather striking documents. One was a file that instructed agents to enhance paranoia and to make people think there was an FBI agent behind every mailbox. Those were, seemed to me at the time to be rather stunning statements to find goals that the Bureau had reduced to writing and distributed to agents. Those files also contained information about the fact that the Bureau had hired as informers switchboard operators, mid-level administrators, and postal carriers on local campuses, people who spied on professors and students and made reports to the FBI. Another very striking discovery in the files that they sent out were documents about the surveillance of black people. It was massive surveillance. At the time, when newspaper editorial writers commented on it, they described it as being Stasi-like, which really was true. It closely resembled the methods then used by what was considered sort of the most dreaded police state operation, the Stasi in the East Germany. The reason that they described it that way is it described the surveillance that was to take place of black people wherever they went in black communities, for instance, their local stores, their high school and college classrooms, restaurants, bars, anywhere that a black person might go, their library, they might come under surveillance. Unlike a white person, there didn't even need to be the slightest sign that somebody was subversive, something that J. Edgar Hoover gave a very broad definition to. Just being black was enough for a black person to come under surveillance. And it specifically described operations that were taking place in neighborhoods in Philadelphia, but it also documented that this was happening all over the United States, and even the methods that were used, including the fact that every FBI agent at that time, except in all white communities, every FBI agent was supposed to hire an informer to report to him on a regular basis on activities of black people, except in Washington, D.C., where every FBI agent was supposed to hire six informers to report to him on a regular basis on the activities of black people. So those were among the findings that the burglars found in media. But then later, when we found out by the end of 1973 what COINTELPRO was, COINTELPRO was on a routing slip in the media file, but it was unexplained. We didn't know what it was. And then NBC reporter Carl Stern asked the FBI for documentation of what those operations were. They refused to provide them, and then he sued and finally succeeded. A judge ordered the FBI to provide information about what COINTELPRO was. And it turned out to be operations that had been in place since 1956, and they were meant to disrupt and destroy even individuals or organizations that he disliked or opposed. And they were sort of ranged from crude things to violent things. such as an example of crude things, injecting the activist oranges with strong laxatives, but then also such extreme things as providing information to a shooter in the police department in Chicago where Fred Hampton slept in his apartment so that the shooter could go there and kill Fred Hampton and one other Black Panther, as they did. Not because he was thought to be violent, but they wanted to do as much damage as they could to the Black Panthers. That informer later received a reward and was congratulated for what he did. I mean, those are examples of the kinds of things that came out. And I suppose the most dramatic example, and one many people know about, is the enormous long campaign that the FBI conducted against Martin Luther King, including an effort just days before he was to receive the Nobel Peace Prize, an effort to convince him to commit suicide.
It's just incredible.
Some of it, as you can tell, would have been unbelievable if documented in the files of any agency. But when it was done by the nation's most powerful law enforcement agency, it really was considered beyond belief.
And how could Hoover, right to the very end of his life, now this occurred, he passed away a short time afterwards.
A little more than a year later.
Yeah, a little more than a year later. How could the guy not feel bulletproof as he did until that burglary? He got away with it through so many regimes. He was the only head of that organization the entire time in its existence. And what they found was, as you were just talking about, these people are running amok.
Yes, he had been the head of it for nearly a half century. There were a few years earlier when it was a much weaker organization, when there were other leaders. But he had been the head of it and essentially had created it in its present form for a half century, which was Congress saw that as part of the problem and passed a law in 1976 saying that FBI director could not serve for longer than 10 years. But you're asked how he got away with it. There was no oversight. There literally was no official oversight. Attorneys general and presidents were supposed to exert oversight, but they didn't. Nicholas Katzenbach testified in 1976 of his effort to try to get him to operate within the law. He refused, and the result, in fact, was Katzenbach. Resignation, although the public did not know that was why he left office. He just had so much strength. He had no oversight in Congress until these revelations came out. But also, journalists did not write about intelligence agencies. Intelligence agencies, until the 1970s, really had a free rein without any official oversight or any journalistic oversight.
In fact,
I should say that at the time of the burglary, one of the people to whom the files were sent at the same time they were sent to me was Jack Nelson, a reporter then in the Washington Bureau of the Los Angeles Times. Jack was actually the only journalist, along with a colleague, Jack Bass from South Carolina, who wrote or did any investigation of the FBI, had written a significant story in 1970. And that was so unusual that in 1971, just as this, before this information started to be revealed, Hoover was conducting a very strong campaign at the Los Angeles Times to get Jack Nelson fired. I mean, the one instance of critical reporting, and he assumed that he could, in fact, get the reporter fired. It was such an unusual thing to have that happen.
And that just shows you the kind of hubris that he had. And I read Nelson's memoirs, and they were so interesting. I guess they were published posthumously after he'd passed away.
That's right.
But
the book is called Scoop.
It's so great. And
it is.
And I'm visiting today with Betty Metzger on the program. The book, her book is great as well, The Burglary. We could talk all day. Betty, we're about out of time here. I want to encourage you to check this book out. It's from Knopf. And again, we have literally only scratched the surface. There is so much stuff in here. I mean, just the things, the one chapter where you unpack some of the just crazy stuff that the FBI looks for in agents and the shape of somebody's head and just all this nutty stuff that you could sit there and go, as you just said, if that wasn't a part of this, if you and I were speaking in general conversation and I told you, yeah, at one time they used to look at the shape of somebody, you go, huh? But the truth is, that stuff was in there, it was in here, and sometimes they say truth is stranger than fiction, and I think in this case, there's a lot of really interesting and strange stuff in this book. Give me a few thoughts here on the way out, if you can.
Well, one thing we didn't say about why J. Edgar Hoover was able to do this kind of, have the Bureau engage in these kinds of activities for so long, was the immense and effective PR operation that he operated within the Bureau very purposely to make Americans think that the FBI was quite different from what it actually was. And so that is also an extremely important point to remember, I think. This included many Hollywood movies made year after year with him having to approve the scripts, a television series every Sunday night on ABC, and ghost-written books, so that the public image was exactly what he wanted it to be. And I just, all of these elements, the lack of official oversight by Congress, by attorney generals, by the press, and then the extremely effective PR operations, I think that they're all points that where the bottom line is the great importance of paying attention and asking questions by the public and by the press and forcing public officials to do the same on our behalf.
And Betty, may we all seek this going forward and never live in the age that we came out of. And I really do appreciate you again joining. Appreciate your time and your talent and for you spending a few minutes with us today on Book Corner.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Betty Metzger, one more time. Check it out. The book is The Burglary, Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI from Knopf. And this concludes this segment of Book Corner. Hey, thanks, Beth.